Hey, it's Otis here. Before we get to the bedtime reading, I wanted to let you know that I just launched a brand new show. It's called The Daily Book Club, a daytime companion to Sleepy, where you hear entire books one chapter at a time, one day at a time. Simple as that. So if Sleepy is how you wind down your day, The Daily Book Club is a great way to start your day. There's new episodes daily. I read in a slightly peppier voice so that you can get really lost in these amazing stories that have stood the test of time. Or, just like Sleepy, you can sit back and relax and zone out to a good book. The first book we'll be reading is The Enchanted April by Elizabeth Von Arnim. Story is, in the 1920s, four women unfulfilled with life take a chance and abscond to a dreamy medieval Italian castle. It's a story dripping with wisteria, the beauty of solitude, and an unlikely pursuit of joy in Portofino, Italy. I think that this is a perfect story for the season, and you can hear it now. Find the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. This show has been a long time coming, and I'm so excited to bring you even more stories. So go subscribe to the Daily Book Club to hear what happens next. Thanks. This episode of Sleepy is proudly sponsored by ButcherBox. If you've listened to Sleepy for a while, you know that I love good food and eating well and treating my body right so that I can take on my days. ButcherBox helps me do exactly that. They deliver super high quality, 100% grass-fed beef and free-range organic chicken, crate-free pork and wild-caught seafood right to your door, humanely raised. No antibiotics or hormones ever, and they have a huge variety to choose from. They have excellent deals, recipes and guides and tips on cooking, and free shipping, always. Eating well is a huge factor in getting a good night's sleep, as is sometimes saving the trip to the grocery store and taking some stress out of your schedule. Well, I have been loving these deliveries. I've been cooking up their steak tips with eggs in the morning, cooked up with a little bit of butter and scallions and soy sauce. And I also made a delicious brined chicken roast with a lemon parsley gravy. Yeah, ButcherBox has made me very happy. Well, today, ButcherBox is giving Sleepy listeners free ground beef for life with your membership, plus an additional $20 off your first order. Use my link, butcherbox.com/sleepy, and use code SLEEPY to get free ground beef for life, plus $20 off your first box. That's butcherbox.com/sleepy and use the code SLEEPY. The link for this will also be in the show notes. Eat well, sleep well.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, and you're listening to Sleepy. A podcast where I read old books to help you get to sleep. I've got a lovely story by P.G. Wodehouse for you tonight. Before we get to the bedtime reading, I just want to tell you that this episode is very proudly sponsored by Shopify. If you have a business or you've been wanting to start your own business, Shopify helps you do your thing. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or handmade leather jackets, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you convert browsers online to real paying customers so that you can sell more with less effort. It's legit. It's the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. They've got great customer service, and they want to help you grow. As an entrepreneur myself, I crave anything that helps me keep my business running smoother so that I can have time, which is so precious to me, so that I can do more of what I love, like reading books to you. Shopify helps people like me do just that, and they can help you too. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/otis, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/OTIS to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/OTIS. I'll put a link for this in the description of the show as well. And now, I'd like to thank our brand new patrons on Patreon.com, which is a website where you can pledge a couple bucks for an ad-free version of the show. So, this week's wonderful new patrons: Lori Drummond Chernichan, Lori Neubauer, Monica Pelage, Allison Stone, Stephen Clifford Ames, Irene Gardner, Bess, Richard Chandler, Stacy Hatfield, Jean Lyon, Marsha, and Rebecca Coffey. Thank you all so, so much for being a part of making this show. Really, really, really means a lot. Thank you. And for anyone who doesn't know, these names that I just read are brand new supporters of Sleepy on Patreon.com, which is a website that allows you to directly support the people who make the stuff that you like. So if you like the Sleepy podcast and you want to be directly a part of making this show, you go to patreon.com/sleepyradio and donate even $1 a month. $2, like I said, gets you access to the ad-free version of Sleepy. $5 gets you access to the poetry feed, where there's over 50 episodes that you have not heard before. But no matter how much you donate, even if it's a dollar, I will read your name in the opening credits of the next show after you do. So again, if you would like to be a part of making this show, go to patreon.com/sleepyradio. Thank you. And as always, the music you're hearing is by my good friend James Lepkowski, and the cover art for Sleepy is by Gracie Kanan. So, I actually have not, until this year, started reading the works of P.G. Wodehouse, and this is now the second episode from his writing, and I absolutely adore it. He might be one of my new favorite writers. His writing, it just really feels like it was meant to be read out loud. There's a certain feeling of joy behind it, I guess. Yeah, it's just really wonderful to read. So today, in honor of spring, which for me cannot come soon enough, I'm going to be reading the first chapter of his book, Something New. And not only does the title kind of feel attractive for this time of year, but also it does take place on a spring day, which was really nice to read. It made me feel like spring is right around the corner, which I really hope it is. So I hope you enjoy falling asleep to this wonderful writing. Tonight, Something New by P.G. Wodehouse. And now's the time for you to fluff up your pillow just how you like it. Feel yourself melt into your bed. Get real comfortable. Close your eyes. And let me read to you. Chapter 1. The sunshine of a fair spring morning fell graciously on London town. Out in Piccadilly, its heartening warmth seemed to infuse into traffic and pedestrians alike a novel jauntiness, so that bus drivers jested and even the lips of chauffeurs uncurled into not unkindly smiles. Policemen whistled at their posts, clerks on their way to work. Beggars approached the task of trying to persuade perfect strangers to bear the burden of their maintenance with that optimistic vim which makes all the difference. It was one of those happy mornings. At 9 o'clock precisely, the door of number 7 Arundel Street, Leicester Square, opened and a young man stepped out. Of all the spots in London which may fairly be described as backwaters, there is none that answers so completely to the description as Arundel Street, Leicester Square. Passing along the north sidewalk to the square, just where it joins Piccadilly, you hardly notice the bottleneck opening of the tiny cul-de-sac. Day and night the human flood roars past, ignoring it. Arundel Street is less than 40 yards in length, and though there are 2 hotels in it, they are not fashionable hotels. It is just a backwater. In shape, Arundel Street is exactly like one of those flat stone jars in which Italian wine of the cheaper sort is stored. The narrow neck that leads off Leicester Square opens abruptly into a small court. Hotels occupy 2 sides of this. The 3rd is at present given up to rooming houses for the impecunious. These are always just going to be pulled down in the name of progress to make room for another hotel. But they never do meet with that fate. And as they stand now, so will they in all probability stand for generations to come. They provide single rooms of moderate size, the bed modestly hidden during the day behind a battered screen. The rooms contain a table, an easy chair, a hard chair, a bureau, and a round tin bath, which, like the bed, goes into hiding after its useful work is performed. And you may rent one of these rooms, with breakfast thrown in for $5 a week. Ash Marson had done so. He had rented the 2nd floor front of number 7. 26 years before this story opens, there had been born to Joseph Marson, minister, and Sarah, his wife of Hailing, Massachusetts, in the United States of America, a son. This son, christened Ash after a wealthy uncle who subsequently double-crossed them by leaving his money to charities, in due course proceeded to Harvard to study for the ministry. So far as can be ascertained from contemporary records, he did not study a great deal for the ministry. But he did succeed in running the mile in 4 minutes and a half, and the half mile at a correspondingly rapid speed, and his researchers in the art of long jumping won him the respect of all. That he should be awarded, at the conclusion of his Harvard career, one of those scholarships at Oxford University instituted by the late Cecil Rhodes for the encouragement of the liberal arts, was a natural sequence of events. That was how Ash came to be in England. The rest of Ash's history follows almost automatically. He won his blue for athletics at Oxford, and gladdened thousands by winning the mile and the half mile 2 years in succession against Cambridge at Queen's Club. But owing to the pressure of other engagements, he unfortunately omitted to do any studying, and when the hour of parting arrived, he was peculiarly unfitted for any of the learned professions. Having, however, managed to obtain a sort of degree, enough to enable him to call himself a Bachelor of Arts, and realizing that you can fool some of the people some of the time, he applied for and secured a series of private tutorships. A private tutor is a sort of blend of poor relation and nursemaid, and a few of the stately homes of England are without one. He is supposed to instill learning and deportment into the small son of the house, But what he is really there for is to prevent the latter from being a nuisance to his parents when he is home from school on his vacation. Having saved a little money at this dreadful trade, Ash came to London and tried newspaper work. After 2 years of moderate success, he got in touch with the Mammoth Publishing Company. The Mammoth Publishing Company, which controls several important newspapers, a few weekly journals, and a number of other things, does not disdain the pennies of the office boy and the junior clerk. One of its many profitable ventures is a series of paper-covered tales of crime and adventure. It was here that Ash found his niche. Those adventures of Gridley Quayle, Investigator, which were so popular with a certain section of the reading public, were his work. Until the advent of Ash and Mr. Quayle, the British Pluck Library had been written by many hands and had included the adventures of many heroes. But in Gridley Quayle, the proprietors held that the ideal had been reached, and Ash received a commission to conduct the entire British Pluck Library monthly himself. On the meager salary paid for these labors, he had been supporting himself ever since. That was how Ash came to be in Arundel Street, Leicester Square, on this May morning. He was a tall, well-built, fit-looking young man, with a clear eye and a strong chin. And he was dressed, as he closed the front door behind him, in a sweater, flannel trousers, and rubber-soled gymnasium shoes. In one hand he bore a pair of Indian clubs, in the other a skipping rope. Having drawn in and expelled the morning air in a measured and solemn fashion, which the initiated observer would have recognized as that scientific deep breathing so popular nowadays, he laid down his clubs, adjusted his rope, and began to skip. When he had taken the second floor front of number 7, 3 months before, Ash Marson had realized that he must forego those morning exercises which had become a second nature for him, or else defy London's unwritten law and brave London's mockery. He had not hesitated long. Physical fitness was his gospel. On the subject of exercise, he was confessedly a crank. He decided to defy London. The first time he appeared in Arundel Street, in his sweater and flannels, he had barely whirled his Indian clubs once around his head before he had attracted the following audience. A. Two cabmen, one intoxicated. B. Four waiters from the Hotel Mathis. C. Six waiters from the Hotel Previtali. D. Six chambermaids from the Hotel Mathis. E. Five chambermaids from the Hotel Previtali. F. The proprietor of the Hotel Mathis. G. The proprietor of the Hotel Previtali. H. The street cleaner. I. 11 nondescript loafers. J. 27 children. K. A cat. They all laughed, even the cab, and kept on laughing. The intoxicated cabman called Ash Sunny Jim, and Ash kept on swinging his clubs. A month later, such is the magic of perseverance, his audience had narrowed down to the 27 children. They still laughed, but without that ringing conviction which the sympathetic support of their elders had lent them. And now, after 3 months, the neighborhood, having accepted Ash and his morning exercises as a natural phenomenon, paid him no further attention. On this particular morning, Ash Marson skipped with even more than his usual vigor. This was because he wished to expel, by means of physical fatigue, a small devil of discontent, of whose presence within him he had been aware of ever since getting out of bed. It is in the spring that the ache for larger life comes on us, and this was a particularly mellow spring morning. It was the sort of morning when the air gives us a feeling of anticipation, the feeling that, on a day like this, things surely cannot go jogging along in the same dull old groove, a premonition that something romantic and exciting is about to happen to us. But the southwest wind of spring brings also remorse. We catch the vague spirit of unrest in the air, and we regret our misspent youth. Ash was doing this. Even as he skipped, he was conscious of a wish that he had studied harder at college and was now in a position to be doing something better than hack work for a soulless publishing company. Never before had he been so completely certain that he was sick to death of the rut into which he had fallen. Skipping brought no balm. He threw down his rope and took up the Indian clubs. Indian clubs left him still unsatisfied. The thought came to him that it was long since he had done his Larson exercises. Maybe they would heal him. The Larson exercises, invented by a certain Lieutenant Larson of the Swedish Army, have almost every sort of merit. They make a man strong, supple, and slender. But they are not dignified. Indeed, to one seeing them suddenly and without warning for the first time, they are markedly humorous. The only reason why King Henry of England, whose son sank with the White Ship, never smiled again, was because Lieutenant Larson had not then invented his admirable exercises. So complacent, so insolently unself-conscious had Ash become in the course of 3 months, owing to his success in inducing the populace to look on anything he did with the indulgent eye of the understanding, that it simply did not occur to him, when he abruptly twisted his body into the shape of a corkscrew, in accordance with the directions of the lieutenant's book for the consummation of exercise one, that he was doing anything funny. And the behavior of those present seemed to justify his confidence. The proprietor of the Hotel Mathis regarded him without a smile. The proprietor of the Hotel Previtali might have been in a trance, for all the interest he displayed. The hotel employees continued their tasks impassively. The children were blind and dumb. The cat, across the way, stopped its backbone against the railings unheeding. But even as he unscrambled himself and resumed a normal posture, from his immediate rear, there rent the quiet morning air a clear and musical laugh. It floated out on the breeze and hit him like a bullet. 3 months ago, Ash would have accepted the laugh as inevitable and would have refused to allow it to embarrass him. But long immunity from ridicule had sapped his resolution. He spun round with a jump, flushed and self-conscious. From the window of the first floor front of number 7, a girl was leaning. The spring sunshine played on her golden hair and lit up her bright blue eyes, fixed on his flanneled and sweatered person with a fascinated amusement. Even as he turned, the laugh smote him afresh. For the space of perhaps 2 seconds, they stared at each other, eye to eye. Then she vanished into the room. Ash was beaten. 3 months ago, a million girls could have laughed at his morning exercises without turning him from his purpose. Today, this one scoffer, alone and unaided, was sufficient for his undoing. The depression which exercise had begun to dispel surged back on him. He had no heart to continue. Sadly, gathering up his belongings, he returned to his room and found a cold bath tame and uninspiring. The breakfasts, included in the rent, provided by Mrs. Bell, the landlady of number 7, were held by some authorities to be specially designed to quell the spirits of their victims should they tend to soar excessively. By the time Ash had done his best with the disheveled fried egg, the chicory blasphemously called coffee, and the charred bacon, misery had him firmly in its grip. And when he forced himself to the table and began to try to concoct the latest of the adventures of Gridley Quail, investigator, his spirit groaned within him. This morning, as he sat and chewed his pen, his loathing for Gridley seemed to have reached its climax. It was his habit, in writing these stories, to think of a good title first, and then fit an adventure into it. And overnight, in a moment of inspiration, he had jotted down on an envelope the words, "The Adventure of the Wand of Death." It was with the sudden repulsion of a vegetarian who finds a caterpillar in his salad that he now sat glaring at them. The title had seemed so promising overnight, so full of strenuous possibilities. It was still speciously attractive. But now that the moment had arrived for writing, the story's flaws became manifest. What was a wand of death? It sounded good. But coming down to hard facts, what was it? You cannot write a story about a wand of death without knowing what a wand of death is. And conversely, if you've thought of such a splendid title, you cannot jettison it offhand. Ash rumpled his hair and gnawed his pen. There came a knock at the door. Ash spun round in his chair, and this was the last straw. If he had told Mrs. Ball once that he was never to be disturbed in the morning on any pretext whatsoever, he had told her 20 times. It was simply too infernal to be endured if his work time was to be cut into like this. Ash ran over in his mind a few opening remarks. "Come in," he shouted, and braced himself for battle. A girl walked in. The girl of the first floor front, the girl with the blue eyes, who had laughed at his Larson exercises. Various circumstances contributed to the poorness of the figure Ash cut in the opening moments of this interview. In the first place, he was expecting to see his landlady, whose height was about 4'6", and the sudden entry of somebody who was about 5'7" threw the universe temporarily out of focus. In the second place, in anticipation of Mrs. Bell's entry, he had twisted his face into a forbidding scowl. And it was no slight matter to change this, on the spur of the moment, into a pleasant smile. Finally, the man who has been sitting for half an hour in front of a sheet of paper bearing the words, "The Adventure of the Wand of Death," and trying to decide what a wand of death might be, has not his mind under proper control. The net result of these things was that, for perhaps half a minute, Ash behaved absurdly. He goggled and he yammered. An alienist, had one been present, would have made up his mind about him without further investigation. For an appreciable time, he did not think of rising from his seat. When he did, the combined leap and twist he executed practically amounted to a Larson exercise. Nor was the girl unembarrassed. If Ash had been calmer, he would have observed on her cheek the flush which told that she, too, was finding the situation trying. But, a woman being ever better equipped with poise than man, it was she who spoke first. "I'm afraid I'm disturbing you." "No, no," said Ash. "Oh, no, not at all, not at all. No. Oh, no, not at all, no," and would have continued to play on the theme indefinitely had not the girl spoken again. "I wanted to apologize," she said, "for the abominable rudeness in laughing at you just now. It was idiotic of me, and I don't know why I did it. I'm sorry." Science, with a thousand triumphs to her credit, has not yet succeeded in discovering the correct reply for a young man to make who finds himself in the appalling position of being apologized to by a pretty girl. If he says nothing, he seems sullen and unforgiving. If he says anything, he makes a fool of himself. Ash, hesitating between these two courses, suddenly caught sight of the sheet of paper over which he had been poring so long. "What is a wand of death?" he asked. "I beg your pardon?" "A wand of death." "I don't understand." The delirium of the conversation was too much for Ash. He burst out laughing. A moment later, the girl did the same. The simultaneously embarrassment ceased to be. "I suppose you think I'm mad," said Ash. "Certainly," said the girl. "Well, I should have been if you hadn't come in."
"Why was that?"
"I was trying to write a detective story." "I was wondering whether you were a writer."
"Do you write?"
"Yes." "Do you ever read Home Gossip?"
"Never."
"You are quite right to speak in that thankful tone. It's a horrid little paper. All brown paper patterns and advice to the lovelorn and puzzles. I do a short story for it every week under various names. A duke or an earl goes with each story. I loathe it intensely." "I'm sorry for your troubles," said Ash firmly. "But we are wandering from the point. What is a wand of death?"
"A wand of death.
A wand of death." The girl frowned reflectively. "Why, of course. It's the sacred ebony stick stolen from the Indian temple, which is supposed to bring death to whoever possesses it. The hero gets hold of it, and the priests dog him and send him threatening messages. What else could it be?" Ash could not restrain his admiration.
"This is genius."
"Oh, no. Absolute genius. I see it all. The hero calls in Gridley Quayle, and that patronizing man, by the aid of a series of wicked coincidences, solves the mystery. And there am I, with another month's work done." She looked at him with interest. "Are you the author of Gridley Quayle? Don't tell me you read him."
"I do not read him. But he is published by the same firm that publishes Home Gossip, and I can't help seeing his cover sometimes while I am waiting in the waiting room to see the editress."
Ash felt like one who meets a boyhood's chum on a desert island. Here was a real bond between them. "Does the Mammoth publish you, too?"
"Why, we are comrades in misfortune, fellow serfs. We should be friends.
Shall we be friends?"
"I should be delighted."
"Shall we shake hands, sit down, and talk about ourselves a little?"
"But I am keeping you from your work."
"An errand of mercy." She sat down. It is a simple act, this act of sitting down. But like everything else, it may be an index of character. There was something wholly satisfactory to Ash in the manner in which this girl did it. She neither seated herself on the extreme edge of the easy chair, as one braced for instant flight, nor did she wallow in the easy chair, as one come to stay for the weekend. She carried herself in an unconventional situation with an unstudied self-confidence that he could not sufficiently admire. Etiquette is not rigid in Arundel Street, but nevertheless, a girl in a first-floor front may be excused for showing surprise and hesitation when invited to a confidential chat with a second-floor front young man whom she has known for only 5 minutes. But there is a Freemasonry
among those who live in large cities on small earnings. "Shall we introduce ourselves?" said Ash. "Or did Mrs. Bell tell you my name? By the way, you have not been here long, have you?" "I took my room day before yesterday, but your name, if you are the author of Gridley Quail, is Felix Clovelly, isn't it?" "Good heavens, no. Surely you don't think anyone's name could really be Felix Clovelly. That is only the cloak under which I hide my shame. My real name is Marson, Ash Marson. And yours?" "Valentine, Joan Valentine." "Will you tell me the story of your life, or shall I tell you mine first?" "I don't know that I have any particular story. I am an American." "Not American." "Why not?" "Because it is too extraordinary, too much like a Gridley Quail coincidence. I am an American." "Well, so are a good many other people." "You miss the point. We are not only fellow serfs, we are fellow exiles. You can't round the thing off by telling me you were born in Hayling, Massachusetts, I suppose." "I was born in New York." "Surely not. I didn't know anybody was." "Why Hayling, Massachusetts?" "That was where I was born." "I'm afraid I never heard of it." "Strange. I know your hometown quite well, but I have not yet made my birthplace famous. In fact, I doubt whether I ever shall. I'm beginning to realize that I am one of those failures." "How old are you?"
26.
"You are only 26 and you call yourself a failure? I think that is a shameful thing to say." "What would you call a man of 26 whose only means of making a living was the writing of Gridley Quail stories, an empire builder?" "How do you know it's your only means of making a living? Why don't you try something new?" "Such as?" "How should I know? Anything that comes along. Good gracious, Mr. Marson. Here you are in the biggest city in the world, with chances for adventure simply shrieking to you on every side." "I must be deaf. The only thing I have heard shrieking to me on every side has been Mrs. Bell for the week's rent." "Read the papers. Read the advertisement columns. I'm sure you will find something sooner or later. Don't get into a groove. Be an adventurer. Snatch at the next chance, whatever it is." Ash nodded. "Continue," he said. "Proceed. You are stimulating me." "But why should you want a girl like me to stimulate you? Surely London is enough to do it without my help. You can always find something new, surely." "Listen, Mr. Marson, I was thrown on my own resources about 5 years ago. Never mind how. Since then, I've worked in a shop, done typewriting, been on the stage, had a position as governess, been a lady's maid."
"A what?
A lady's maid?" "Why not? It was all experience. And I can assure you, I would much rather be a lady's maid than a governess." "I think I know what you mean. I was a private tutor once. I suppose a governess is the female equivalent. I've often wondered what General Sherman would have said about private tutoring if he expressed himself so breezily about mere war. Was it fun being a lady's maid?" "It was pretty good fun, and it gave me an opportunity of studying the aristocracy in its native haunts, which has made me home gossip's established authority on dukes and earls." Ash drew a deep breath, not a scientific deep breath, but one of admiration. You are perfectly splendid. Splendid? I mean, you have such pluck. Oh well, I keep on trying. I'm 23 and I haven't achieved anything much yet, but I certainly don't feel like sitting back and calling myself a failure. Ash made a grimace. All right, he said. I've got it. I meant you too, said Joan placidly. I hope I haven't bored you with my autobiography, Mr. Marson. I'm not setting myself up as a shiny example, but I do like action and hate stagnation. You are absolutely wonderful, said Ash. You are a human correspondence course in efficiency, one of those ones you see advertised in the back pages of the magazines. Young man, are you earning enough? With a picture showing the deadbeat gazing wistfully at the boss's chair. You would galvanize a jellyfish. If I have really stimulated you. I think that was another slam, said Ash pensively. Well, I deserve it. Yes, you have stimulated me. I feel like a new man. It's queer that you should have come to me right at the top of everything else. I don't remember when I have felt so restless and discontented as this morning. It's the spring. I suppose it is. I feel like doing something big and adventurous. Well, do it then. You have a Morning Post on the table. Have you read it yet? I glanced at it. But you haven't read the advertisement pages? Read them. They may contain just the opening you want. Well, I'll do it. But my experience of advertisement pages is that they are monopolized by philanthropists who want to lend you any sum from 10 to 100,000 pounds on your note of hand only. However, I will scan them. Joan rose and held out her hand. Goodbye, Mr. Marson. You've got your detective story to write, and I have to think out something with a duke in it by tonight, so I must be going. She smiled. We have traveled a good way from the point where we started, but I may as well go back to it before I leave you. I'm sorry I laughed at you this morning. Ash clasped her hand in a fervent grip. I'm not. Come and laugh at me whenever you feel like it. I like being laughed at. Why, when I started my morning exercises, half of London used to come and roll about on the sidewalks in convulsions. I'm not an attraction any longer, and it makes me feel lonesome. There are 29 of those Larson exercises, and you saw only part of the first. You have done so much for me that if I can be of any use to you in helping you to greet the day with a smile, I shall be only too proud. Exercise 6 is a surefire mirth provoker. I'll start with it tomorrow morning. I can also recommend exercise 11, a scream. Don't miss it. Very well. Well, goodbye for the present. Goodbye. She was gone. And Ash, thrilling with new emotions, stared at the door which had closed behind her. He felt as though he had been wakened from sleep by a powerful electric shock. Close beside the sheet of paper on which he had inscribed the now luminous and suggestive title of his new Gridley Quayle story lay the Morning Post, the advertisement columns of which he had promised her to explore. The least he could do was to begin at once. His spirits sank as he did so. It was the same old game. A Mr. Brian McNeil, though doing no business with minors, was willing, even anxious, to part with his vast fortune to anyone over the age of 21 whose means happened to be a trifle straitened. This good man required no security whatever. nor did his rivals in generosity, the Messieurs Angus Bruce, Duncan MacFarlane, Wallace McIntosh, and Donald MacNabb. They, too, showed a curious distaste for dealing with minors. But anyone of mature years could simply come around to the office and help himself. Ash threw the paper down wearily. He had known all along that it was no good. Romance was dead, and the unexpected no longer happened. He picked up his pen and began to write. The Adventure of the Wand of Death. Thank you for listening to Sleepy. Good night.